start your new method of cooking meals in a local school because it brings up a fight against the local tradition. And you know, then he goes out and starts something radical and uses monasteries or insurance. Something unheard of. And never before had a house of God be allowed to be called after one name of the Trinity. I told you that the church either has to be called in honor of the Trinity, of the living God as the original creation, or as the Church of Christ, as the incarnation of God on this earth. But the Holy Spirit, he says, is vague if it is only, because then it can become just the idea of one genius. The Holy Spirit, however, always ties together two times. And in the Trinity, this is clearly expressed by using the terms for Father and Son. It always means two generations at least. Or it means the whole time of antiquity against the whole Christian era. It always means the tremendous relation of time. Before first Christ and after Christ would be one relation of Father and Son. Or the Old Testament and the New Testament, the law and grace. Now we came back to Paris, and I said that at the end of his life he did teach in the schools on the left bank of the river as a freelance teacher. And out of this clash, the faculty of Paris arose as a true university faculty. And he said that a higher school of learning can only exist as an appointment, not made from the outside, but where the group that is already in the situation can co-elect, you see, and include into its membership. Because only then can the standards be developed from actual teaching. This is a very acute problem today, gentlemen. A friend of mine is going to start a world university somewhere in Europe. And he naively thinks that when he invites Germany and France and Italy and England to contribute to such a world university, he will have a world university. He will then hire a German and a Frenchman and an American and an Englishman, and all old and below, there's a world university. That's the idea on which children go about their business today in the world of affairs. And that's why the spirit today is dead as a dodo. You can't found a new institution in this silly manner that somebody else appoints teachers and then say you are members of a world university. Because the people who go there before have just been Americans and Frenchmen and Englishmen. And they have changed. You have to divest yourself first of your old allegiances by an act of your own life, in your own life and in your own thinking, before you can become the nucleus of something new. And I try to show you that Abelard, by divesting himself of his membership in the Cathedral School of Paris, by first going in exile, by first going into this monastery of the Holy Spirit, separated himself from the old ways and lived his new method and suffered for it. And then you can be perhaps the seed of a new type of man and way of life. Today, gentlemen, nobody ever wants to suffer for the new way of life. He doesn't want to divest himself in hard daily practice of one way of thinking. So if this man, this friend of mine, will succeed in getting his world university, he will just be sham and fickle. Because every member there, they will be just what he has been before. Because he hasn't done anything under his own steam to become a member of world thinking. That isn't so simple as you think. And that's why nothing happens today in the world. You have this UNESCO. That's a better joke. This Mr. Huxley has, of course. He's our listening. Whenever there was one, now he travels around and appears in other places, but that doesn't change him being an Englishman. He has never done anything before seizing any thought of being an Englishman, before he was appointed. He must appoint a man for what he has done. That is, gentlemen, in the realm of thought, the thinker must deliver the goods before he's paid for. And then later you can appoint him for what he has done and say, that's the man, he did it. But you always try the other way around. You cannot take any old war horse and say, now do something new. He remains the old war horse. And nobody knows this yet. You think for money you can get anything, you can buy anything. Yet you can always buy something what is there, but you cannot produce new people. New people, the founders, gentlemen, are people who take a first step at a time and nobody else knows of this first step. Somebody has to do it first. But you will always think there is somebody outside who can, so to speak, pay a man, and then he will be me. Then nobody becomes you for money. It's impossible. First, the man must deliver the goods. And then the world, after a while, recognizes that there is a new man. First of all, the slander and the persecution. And gradually, they take to it and say, it's very nice. But not that to discover the first America. There was nobody else who could say, go and discover America. Can you see this? But you all think it can be done that way. Everyone in this world today, by the way, the world has always been this way, tries to live by caricatures, by goals, by substitutes, by second-rate living. There would be no founder there, and if somebody else could take it upon himself to tell him, now act in a new society, then the man who would say so would already have to have lived this new society. If something is really new, gentlemen, it is at one time not yet existing. Jesus was not existent before he had lived. Nobody could tell him to become Jesus. He had to say it to himself. A very dangerous performance. People thought therefore he was crazy. His mother thought so. And he was crazy. Because anybody who is something first is in the eyes of the rest of the world insane. Abelard seems to his contemporaries therefore crazy. A madman. To be condemned. The same is true of our friend Paracelsus. And I think in order to stimulate your thinking, gentlemen, as to the founding of the University of Paris, I wish now immediately to confront you with the process of founding the social sciences and founding the academic sciences, the natural sciences. You have read the pamphlet on Paracelsus, I take it. And I now wish to bring out the points which Paracelsus had to live in order to be able to become the first teacher, the first founder of a new method of observing the facts of nature. That's exactly parallel to the founding of a university. The university, he said, is founded on the principle that two schools of thought at the same time or at the same place teach the same people, the same students, opposite points of view on the same topic. Remember? The academic science, gentlemen, the natural sciences, consists of a constant conflict between teaching and research. The conflict between the natural sciences is not that at the same place two opposite ideas on geology are held. You don't have to have your two professors of geology, one teaching the volcanic and the other the Neptunic line of thought. It is enough, gentlemen, that the geology professor here at Dartmouth, is constantly aware that what he teaches today may have to be revised tomorrow, and therefore impresses on his students the situation in which his teaching is, that it is only true so far, and may be superseded by another expedition to Alaska tomorrow. So, gentlemen, the contradiction in the natural sciences is between teaching one thing and searching for another. That is the same as in theology. In theology, you have St. Augustine teaching one thing and St. Ambrosius teaching another, and equalizing the two, you see, but the great authorities are already all there. Yeah, how the theology only arose when the contradictions all had been fully stated. In natural science, it is the other way. There is a tradition about our knowledge of the globe in 1500. It's in the classical books of the ancient scientists of Greece. And Paracelsus comes and brushes it aside and says, you have to walk over the whole globe, and you have to think in all the experiences and observations from everywhere, and you have to be ready to overthrow your teacher. And therefore the students must be told that what they hear is doubtful. Gentlemen, any teaching in the natural sciences is conditioned on tomorrow it will be different. In theology, that is not so. On God, gentlemen, we believe the expectation is not that it will be different. That we have to concord to tell the contradiction that God is charitable and severe. That he punishes the bastard and poor generation getting merciful forever and forever and forever. That to tell the God for every generation why there the word war, you see, and why it was merciful. And the question of evil and of eternity and the question of sin are eternal questions. Gentlemen, in the medieval science there is not the same research to be done as in the natural sciences. What has to be done is concording. The recording of the ultimate contradictions, which are already all known. They are all infinite. That the world is abstruse and absurd, you see, that people knew in 1100 just as well as they know today. You see? But they showed ways of reconciling this. You see? And then you can choose between various ways of reconciling it. And you have to gain in every student this heavy weight on his heart that it has to be reconciled. In other words, gentlemen, in the medieval science, in the university, the whole problem is the load on the teacher's heart to make the heart of the student equally heavy, equally interested, because if the next generation does not again find that the problem of evil weighs heavy on his heart, he will not enter upon the solution. And so, the next generation and the future of mankind will be without any sense of importance. Of what is important. In the academic science, gentlemen, the situation is different. The data are not all in. We don't know yet how contradictory our observations of the far distant stars are to our records about the solar system. There are contradictions that we observe more and more every day. So, gentlemen, the contradiction in the natural sciences are between different things as in the scholastic sciences. The question of an unjust law and the right to resist it is an eternal question. Since Cain and Adam and Abel and Abraham and Noah, there have always been the same questions as there have been tyrants and unjust laws. You are answers that believe in the right of religion. You don't. So, why? Because for 100 years you haven't been told the importance of religion. Therefore, the right of religion is dying in this country. I asked the other course the other day how the students in class would react if the FBI came and wanted to arrest a friend who just spent the night at his house and to whom he had offered hospitality. And he unanimously said their first reaction would be to give him over to the FBI. Now, 100 years ago, the first reaction in this country would have been to hide him from the FBI. In other words, gentlemen, the religious aspect of hospitality has disappeared from your hearts. Your heart is no longer caught and gripped by the sacredness of your hospitality, that you are the host and he is the guest, and he is at your mercy, and therefore you have to be merciful as God is. You are no longer God to your host, yes, but you are just a little human being who trembles when the FBI comes and says, please, take him over. I wash my hands of him. This is not only in the case of houses, though, you see it in the case of college presidents, who jettison their teachers if they are considered well, and so on. That is the gratefulness of hospitality and protection by you given to somebody else. Your divine quality of being able to protect other men's lives has fast disappeared from your heart. We haven't made it important. It doesn't weigh on you. Therefore, this eternal question of endless laws, of tyranny, of hospitality, of protection, of self-defense, you see, even at this moment, not in you. It isn't impossible. You, the right of resistance is disappearing fast from this country. Your generation is a regimented generation, by and large. You may rebel individually against it, but you will not deny that the mass of your colleagues in this college want to have their peace and want to be left alone, even if it's such a rather is killed. That's very serious, gentlemen. If we give you an example. How do you pronounce it? Not Chiro. Chiro. Well, gentlemen, there you see the question. Can you grasp the difference between a legal or theological question and an academic question? The question of after an oak tree or a mammoth can only be solved if you bring in new bones of another mammoth, you see, from another region. Then everything we said about the mammoth may have to be revised. Yeah? And so, academic questions, gentlemen, are based on new observations before they cannot be finally answered. But legal questions and theological questions are based on our sense of what is important in the question. You say, if the FBI comes, it is important that I shouldn't be disturbed in my way of life, so I wash my hands of every disturbance. I wish to conform. Just leave me alone. Otherwise, I couldn't go to the picnic anymore. It would cost my time. Think if you have to defend your friend, conceal your friend from the FBI, it may take you to strange lands. You may miss your appointment tomorrow. It all is today. You can only give your time to something important because otherwise you get off schedule. Gentlemen, the question of importance always involves a distinction between internal values and immediate values. You have always to pause if you wish to give importance to a legal question. You are slandered, gentlemen. Take this question. You are slandered. Now, you know the laws of this country make it very difficult to accuse of slander in court. You usually don't get anything out of it, you see. And it is a very costly affair, and the slanderer gets away, you see. You know that. Therefore, most people in this country just know if they are slanderers, they won't do anything against them. There may, however, come a point where you have to sue the man, you see, because he has slandered your wife. Obviously, you can only do this if the honor, you see, of your name is more important than everything you have to do during the next 6 months, because it will cost you at least 6 months and much more, perhaps, until you have brought the case to court and before the truth in the Supreme Court. Therefore, gentlemen, importance always means that you have to pause and makes a distinction between the eternal and the temporal. Any legal or theological question means just this, that you know what is eternally important and what, therefore, has to take second seat in comparison. Otherwise, you can never go to court, for example, because any court action interrupts Mr. Medina's life. The poor man is not at this moment sacrificed for the United States, this Judge Medina. A friend of mine said yesterday to me, every day the paper should print the headline on the Medina case, because it is in the court in New York that today the Constitution of the United States is defended against communism. It's a great case, and probably Mr. Medina will crack. I wouldn't be surprised if he wouldn't try any other case in the future anymore. But you perhaps read it with curiosity, gentlemen, but you read it with a trembling in your heart that this is your case. That the right of jury and court are on trial there today. That if Mr. Dennis and company succeed in breaking Mr. Medina's head and spine and nerve, that there will have been cast a tremendous prejudice on the underdog. In this country, everybody has always sided with the defendant. Everybody who hasn't pleaded guilty was innocent. Every court was sacred for the accused. After this trial, that won't be the case. Since the accused have been able to start a whole conspiracy against the functioning of the court in the United States, these accused, if there is not that they should call themselves communists, will have deleted the privileges of the underdog, because in the future the public will be very suspicious when a man begins to fight in court for his rights. They'll be annoyed and they'll say he's just a mutant. We know that. That has never happened before in the United States, gentlemen. The Medina case is the first onslaught on the Constitution of the United States. It is very strange. The accused gentlemen in our tried for saying that they want to use violence in the United States against the government of the United States. You know, that's the whole case. And the naive reader of this accusation thinks that this violence would be applied in the streets, in the barracks, in the battleships, in the factories, you see, to blow up the government of the United States. Instead, the government of the United States is now blown up in the courtroom. It's the only place where the communists in this country have a faint chance of using their dynamite. We don't have to fear communism in factories, we don't have to fear it in courts, we don't have to fear it in any other place. But we say, in the judiciary, they are at this moment using violence against the government of the United States. You see the paradox? That they are tried, and that this case itself is now turning out to be the only violence they can successfully use. Isn't this a strange story? Now, gentlemen, if you would really still be identical with the Constitution of the United States, if you would identify yourself with it as real American citizens, you would demand from your newspaper to read a full stenographic report, and you would tremble for the health and survival of Judge Medina. And you would write him letters of comfort and send him a bottle of champagne. I mean it. next out of his moments of full performance of the attack of Russia on his country. But how is it treated? Just as a sideshow. And on the other hand, because this is not treated as it should be, there are all these Richmond things outside, quite insignificant, trying to find whether a union of food carriers is perhaps contained by the communists. The violence against the United States can be brought against the judicial, against the legislative branch, or against the executive branch. And by this strange turn of events, our judiciary is found open to attack. I can't afford, I understand that these lawyers are not debarred and deformed, that we allow them, with the lawyers, they are too terrified me more than the accused. That these lawyers are allowed attention in this court is just beyond my understanding. Because the danger is, you see, as I said, that the events under those will not have the same graceful hearing from the court. Well, you are very good boy. Don't you think that there is, you see, of course this country has never believed that quantity is equality. You always think bigger is better. But I don't think the longer trial is the better
one.
I feel not. I read this very carefully. I feel that the abuse is so obvious by the defendants. This cannot go. It is only a meaning that could just be so far. As the same thing you said. Could that have been so? You see, we have, I tell you the reason, it is the same reason why we have no successful proceedings against slander. In England, as you know, there is a very strict rule of contempt of court. And contempt of court is not used here by the government. But that's a very serious business. Contempt of court is exactly this act which makes the questioning of the judiciary impossible. And we have every slander, you see. When in England a man gets $500,000 in indemnity, here he gets $1 and has to defray the cost of the trial itself. If a man proves or slander, you see, you know it. In England, the man who has slander, you know. No, this democracy has simply given rein to affection for the underdog, which now has to be corrected in a reasonable way. The sympathy for the underdog is whatever is leading to this abuse of the trial, but it's only true. How long is this trial now going on? Is anybody else to know? Very sorry. What I mean to say is, gentlemen, the case may bring home to you the fact that it is not research which is the question of the medieval university, but conflict of two possible judgments on the matter. If you take the side of the defendant always, you get into this situation as today. The underdog is always, you see, right. You can take another point of view in which you say the judge must be protected. And you can take a third point of view and say that the prosecuting attorney must be protected. I mean, you have three possible solutions of this situation. Side with the person injured, whose child has been kidnapped. If your child is beside the Bruno Hoffman, you kidnap the judge. Or you can protect the jury and the judge, as we do in England. In France and Germany, the sympathy would be with the man injured, with the men who have lost his cow by a thief or his child by a kidnapper. But in this country, the sympathy is with the men who was bold enough to commit a crime and has not yet been able to be convicted. So, gentlemen, in legal and religious and theological questions, take this down. The research is not what moves the science on, but the necessity of bringing to the next generation again the eternal question in such a way that it will weigh heavily on their hearts, that it will become important. The old sciences of law and theology face the problem of making the same question newly important. The academic question, however, depends on the possibility of bringing in new facts. Since you believe that the only science is natural science, you cannot be surprised that we have neither a reputable theology nor a reputable jurisprudence in this country. Because these two sciences depend exclusively on importance and not on new facts. They depend on interest, on zest, on a new generation again wishing to conquer the concordance, the opposite points of view. Whereas today, you sit back and say, oh, we send an expedition to the Arctic and they'll find out about the magnetic pole. And that's all what your philosophy has to do. And someone is on some scientist who is sent there, then you know. Modern science, gentlemen, is suspended between teaching of the tradition and research in new facts. And therefore, gentlemen, the academic science originates in a conflict between the existing school and exploration, research, discovery. The discovery of America, the observations of the rotations of the Mars and Venus in the sky led to the new picture of the Earth and of astronomy. The new observations of the bones in anatomy led to the new picture of medical science by the famous anatomist Vesalius. All this happens since after 1500, gentlemen. New observations overthrow old teachings. You may put down, gentlemen, on one side the words tradition, teaching, doctrine, stock of knowledge, and on the other you may put the words discovery, research, exploration, observation, information. Then you have the antagonism, the polarity. You can use any of these two words, to these pairs of words, you see, to express the situation. Now, gentlemen, any doctrine, any science, any tradition, which is taught the children, the boys in school, with the qualification, this is only true so far, is a new type of doctrine. The newness of the Renaissance sciences, gentlemen, about nature, which we call the academic sciences, is that, of course, when the people from Greece came to a German house, they should have hidden the Jews and the social democrats and the nationalists, the conservatives, and it is a shame every German was guilty because he didn't become a hero and protect his friends against Hitler. Now I have a colleague who told me that he has offered to the FBI to inform against him on this fact. So you see how difficult it is always the same measure in the people in the foreign country in your own country. Nobody wants to be a martyr at this moment in this country. And why then why the Germans are terribly wicked than they did? So in 10 years we have run the gamut from demanding once more the duty to resist tyranny in one country far away. And now saying that we of course have no duty to resist the secret police. Do you think the FBI has anything but a gift of hope? What's the difference? Both put in by executive order without any legal foundation, outside the Constitution of the United States. What's the difference? It's just an executive order. It has absolutely nothing to do with your civil rights or the civil union. Yet everybody's rushing in to help the FBI. Now, I don't say that you shouldn't, gentlemen, but be careful that you don't measure with two standards. You have condemned these very things in other countries, in other people's lives. And you have acted accordingly. The Germans on the basis of this have at this moment no state, and they will never have one, probably. On the basis of your moralizing of this fact. And so by you should have no government either. These are very serious questions. It only shows, gentlemen, that I have to talk to you about Bologna and about the conflict of imperial and canon law and its great fruits, the right of resistance. And the same with marriage law, the difference between imperial marriage laws and personal marriage laws, because both are at this moment vanished. The Russians have made this strange law that you can't marry anybody who's not a Russian citizen. That's an interference of the imperial law with the church law. And the right of resistance is here given up immediately if anybody comes to your house and asks for information about anybody else. Gossip has suddenly been dogmatized as a wonderful thing. Mere gossip, which the FBI collects. Oh, I have heard, yes. The last thing I heard was a man was investigated and a woman hurried, of course, to this wonderful opportunity and said, yes, he went to pink school. A pink school. That was the accusation, you see, which he was eager to turn. He went to pink school, whatever that is. But it's a high school, not a college.
Yeah. Is that the reward for resistance? Is it against resistance?
Pardon?
Is that the reward for resistance? Is it going to challenge?
In all instances, the essence of the right of resistance is that you may be killed in the process. If there is no if, sir, you may be sure, gentlemen, that if anybody resists the state, he's apt to be shot in the process. Your ink only shows how far removed you are from reality. You don't even know what the right of resistance means. Because you ask if. But that's the essence of it, gentlemen, that there isn't a situation in which it is preferable to be shot dead on the ground than to survive tyranny. Do you think any tyranny would ever have been laid and ambushed if this wasn't so? Do you think the farmer, the next thing in Concord, had any if? What was the right reason? And what was their reward to be shot dead? Have you ever been to the British Fort? Well, it was very easy to fire both ways. Probably the British soldier could have fired too, but they preferred no rain. My dear man, just show that you are here in an academic situation that I haven't been able to impose on your heart the heaviness of this question, and that you are only at this moment in the cycle of natural scientific thinking, and therefore think, how silly to die for it. How impossible. How can anybody be asked to do this? The medieval man began with the following statement. Since our Lord died on the cross,
There must be many cases in which it is preferable to die than to live. The thing has been summed up very neatly in Kale by Herman Melville at the end of this Who Has Read It? Oh, Herman Melville is an American writer, not a Russian. You are still allowed to read. Who has read Kale or Melville? I thought he was the best American writer.
What have you read by most of you haven't the pilot is. I have yet to find a student who has read Moby Dick from cover to cover. Who has? From cover to cover and everything that's in between? I started to tell you the truth. I still have to find the man who hasn't skimmed over various pages. But Pierre, without Pierre, you don't understand your Moby Dick, and without Moby Dick, you don't understand Pierre, by the way. The book ends on the town in the world. It's speechless with Achilles. Now, that's the climax of the scientific circle of your question, sir. The answer of the human side would have been a speechless with Achilles. It is speechless to be killed in a good dress code. And if you don't know that such kids exist, you don't belong into the cycle which deals with eternity. You only belong into the cycle that deals with temporal knowledge, nor knowledge of changing facts. And that's what you all do. But anybody who is willing to don a uniform must also know that he can be shot in the process of wearing this uniform. It is more sweet, gentlemen, to resist the tyrant than to fight in the battle for your country. It is because it's much more difficult. The tyrant, you see, wears the uniform of your own country. And the enemy, you see, everybody applauds if you resist him. That's it. The tyrant is the same. Why could all the Germans resist the Russians and the French and the British if we kill them but not him? It's a very profound question. But it wasn't the question that they wouldn't fight for anything, that there was the question of danger of life was in both cases exactly the same. If you are a soldier in the United States Army, you have the solid for you. No, gentlemen, you have just shifted the importance. Any man who doesn't resist endless laws will, of course, have to resist the enemy from outdoors who attacks an endless state to which you have to belong. No question, the questions of eternity are not questions which you can escape from. The same people who resist in this country tyranny will peaceful people when it came to the foreign policy of their country and want to go to war. Yeah? Because they still wanted to resist at home. You can see, gentlemen, that eternal things are always with us. If you, however, deny that they are eternal, they will be accepted in an indirect fashion. If 190 million Americans say, I personally cannot do this because I have been killed in the process. There will be a world war, and all the other 90 million people that run the risk of being killed, you see, because not one of them wanted to be killed with some greater degree of danger. There is a scale. Can you have you any graphic genius here who could put this on a scale? You can see that the more
and men take that upon themselves to resist, the less believe he got indirectly in a mass resistance. That the eternal has always to be defended against the temple. Marriage, for example, you see, this law in Russia has to be destroyed. It's an unjust law. It is unjust. And the religion in the South is unjust. Now, if one man in the South, one sheriff, acts free and resists the law boldly, you see, he is in great danger. But the law will be enforced and the religion will die. If, however, no sheriff in the South will protect the Negro against religion, you have to have a militia marching into the South. A whole regiment may have to be mobilized, a whole division, a whole army, for instance. There's much more loss of life by the world. But no individual will think that he directly is in danger of life. The whole peace of the United States may be in jeopardy, as in the Civil War. And so, your choice, gentlemen, in defending eternal values is always in a sliding scale from person to mass. Any non-resistance against corruption in Tammany Hall or in city government makes it more complicated to clean out the Aldean stable. First, the first policeman is bribed, then the second, then the tenth, then hundred, you see. Finally, you have to get, you see, a real landslide to clean out that stable. See, it's much more costly. If the first had resisted, it would have been much more dangerous for him, much more difficult to resist the pressure, you see. But it would have been much more cheap, much more less expensive. So, gentlemen, all eternal values are protected on a gliding scale. The more personality invested in the defense of the eternal, the less expensive the defense. That's an absolute rule. All the American boys today who are willing to enter the army under the draft, but see the FBI, that's too much for me, I can't resist her, them, simply have chosen mass existence to personal existence. I assure you, any person who resists has an infinitely greater influence than 200,000 people who are mobilized to march against the communists. And if you mobilize 200,000 people, much more havoc is there, much more money, crime, blood and tears is spent, of course. Many more families are broken up, as in plenty for one member. But you have just made this choice, that you are to be drafted, but you won't resist. Can you see that your question is wrongly asked? See, it only shifts in direct application to your person. The less you become a person, you see, the more you are exposing great numbers to the same danger of losing your life. Every war can be avoided, gentlemen, if there are enough people. If President Roosevelt had resigned in 1938 and stumped the country for air power, he could have prevented the Third World War, but it would have cost him his office. Now, since nobody in this country will renounce anything voluntarily, it could be done. He had to be president. But there is always a way out. Always. If he had given his own name to this cause, you see, for example, I mean, I'm exaggerating now, but I'm quite sure that it would have had a tremendous effect if the President of the United States would have said, I always wanted to be President, that the peace of the world is more important than the presidency. Instead, he said, the presidency of the United States is so important that I even wish to go to war for it. That was the president's policy. In order to, since I am president, I have to do everything to remain president. But he could have said, peace is so important that I must cease to be president. You have always the other choice, you see. Now that would have been his political death. And that's more painful sometimes than to be killed physically. But you can do it. Can you not? The it is always there. Can you see this? That your question was wrongly asked.
But you don't think that peace was more important than the last war, do you?
Oh, the war is after all only an abortion of peace.
On what is better, war? But what was price? What was the price of the last war? That's what I mean. Why would they not put Roosevelt to commit political suicide so that we could have peace?
Shame on that. He didn't sacrifice his prime minister, did he? He wanted to remain prime minister.
Why didn't Hitler sacrifice
his prime minister? He didn't sacrifice anything. He wanted to have it both ways. No sacrifice and peace, of course, the prime minister. I don't think he takes me this way.
But I had a lot of trouble. But everyone knows that he knew that stopping the country by air power is a very thing.
I don't know. And he didn't.
He wouldn't have really known.
And it may be, you see, the terrible thing about any resistance is that you never know the success. Your question is to this, what's your name, please?
Harvey Von Adorian.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, I should. Well, this question is a very good question because in every American boy's mind, you always exclude danger from your calculations. You will always say it must be riskless. Gentlemen, to any defense of the eternal against the temporal is always unpredictable as to its consequences. Always. Now, if the father and the mother tell the girl whom to marry, that's safe. They know at least that the neighboring estate will be adjacent to their land, and the money bag will marry money bag. You see? And you can predict what happens. If the girl is allowed to say no to, you see, that she is engaged, there's a risk involved. She may never find the right husband. She may never get married. Because we are not, you see, on very safe ground before we left the world. So, gentlemen, the defense of any value, law or religion, by resistance or by any decision, is always risky. You can never make a sacrifice or resist in the sense of comforting if you don't give your heart something. Now, gentlemen, a person who invests his own heart into any action is always apt to hear from the clever people of the brain, why do you expose your heart to getting hurt? If you invest your heart into anything, it is an arm, indefensible. If you tell a girl that you love her, she can help you. So you better spar with her and fence with her that you can't help you. Don't you see, gentlemen, that the very problem of comforting is that you invest your heart, and this means that you don't know the answer, the response on the other side. Nobody who loves his neighbor as himself knows whether the neighbor is going to love him. And of course, therefore, you are told by the world and your parents and your advice, don't do it. It's silly. All right. If it is silly, then the world must end in misery and no increase can be established. Then it is better to deal with what's going to happen, gentlemen, when the girls don't want to have any conflict. They go to the eugenics and psychoanalysts and they tell you what to marry. That's coming. It's already on the march. That the psychoanalyst decides whether a love is to be pursued or not. Fear of freedom, as is the promise for it. I mean, they're running away from freedom. The people today do want to be told by the psychologist that this is the right girl. I have told this
type, what do you say in order to avoid it?
Marry your cousin, marry your fool.
Marry some person who's the same habits. Marry somebody who also likes tea.
It's terrible. It was boring performance.
But no function.
There is no power to concord.
Concordance, gentlemen, is the power of the heart to overcome conflict. You are to an extent, don't have any conflict.
So you can't live. But it is too well, Mr. Horowitz said. You won't die either. You take this down, gentlemen.
Only he can die who has lived. And most people today prefer to this reality of living and dying a situation in which they neither live nor die. Most of you cannot die because you are alive. Things cannot die, dead things cannot die.
Confronted in a simple way.
Dead things cannot die, dead people cannot die.
There are several people in this country, quite famous, who are dead for 30 years, but they don't know it.
You can be dead with all the essential parts of your utterances and your thoughts and still go on eating and sleeping, gentlemen. That's not the whole life of you. If you are in power, if you are the secretary of the American Medical Association. After all, the country is only interested in the fact that he is the secretary of the American Medical Association. Whether he eats or drinks and breathes, these are very minor matters of life. Any jellyfish can do that. But the problem is that the man in any position in life, it's important that he's alive to this position. And this nobody can do without exposing his heart to conflict. And this is what you go with here, because the whole medieval cycle of scientific endeavor has died to you. And you are out of it. The only thing you believe is science, in the sense of science of facts. So let's now go to Paracelsus. Paracelsus is a clear guy. He is a doctor of the body, gentlemen, and he is at the same time a serum in the body. That is, he is a physician who is at the same time inside the medical profession a drop of blood of a new quality, and creating a tremendous disturbance. The case of Paracelsus is such a great case, gentlemen, because you think that a physician is certainly the highest scientific position of a man. I know many social workers who think that social scientists should be doctors of society. I think I've already told you that this is impossible. Inside society, you can only be a leukocyte or red blood corpuscle. I cannot cure society as a physician. I can only be somebody different inside society, and thereby change society. Because I change constitution. It's compound. Remember, we have talked about this before. Now I come back to this in Paracelsus, dear gentlemen, you have here the paradox that the doctor on whom you look as somebody who is able to cure a patient, to cure a case, is in his whole life a new quality in the compound of the medical profession. And much more so, a new element inside the whole professional group of people dealing with things of this earth, from the plumber to the artist, and from the engineer to the doctor, through Paracelsus, the body, social body, who carries on the dealing with machines, with cures, with facts, has become a different quality, has earned a different label, the label academic.
The academic gentleman in Cincinnati is in a crying conflict against the university. So, our paper, I think, was changed from Belgium. That's exactly what happened to Avila in the local university. Paracelsus is in a university based on the principles of the Middle Ages. The university allowed to teach Arabian medicine and Greek medicine and Latin medicine. Avicenna and Galenus, the Latin and the Greek, as they had conflict in Salerno. There you had the two schools of thought, the Oriental thought, and the Latin thought, fall out in the Bible of the Kuzes. Now, in Basel, the medical school was based on the same assumption. Every student had to read up on his Arabian text, translated into Latin, and on his Latin and Greek text. And in comes Paracelsus and says, I'm neither going to speak Latin or Greek, I'm going to speak German, my own native tongue. That I will bring in the facts from all my travels. I will bring the whole world of new facts into this classroom and will bring on the conflict between new facts and old traditions. And if you read the pamphlet, I quoted there this great description of the new principle, that the four and disease has not been investigated on the whole globe. In any part of the globe, you will never know what the disease is. That first of all, we must have met this disease. You see, in any place, before we can know what it is. Therefore, gentlemen, the academic is ubiquitous. The academic spirit is ubiquitous. The university spirit is local. From 1500, gentlemen, to 1650, the academic spirit is split outside the universities. The universities resist. If I can get you to understand that the university and the academic are two different things, you will be highly educated people. In this country, you see, this has been really important. You think that we are in the academic world and that there are universities that are exactly the same. It's the opposite. In universities, there's disputation. There is conflict of ideas. In the academic world, there is conflict of new information and old theories. See the difference? The academic, then, gentlemen, is based on correspondence all over the globe, on information on a global sphere. To give you some examples, gentlemen. Let me, I have the committed the crime of giving you without advice. But please allow me to, because there is no sense there to say right now. Let me dictate you some points that you can do even though you are tired. The principle of the academic world is the gathering of information outside the local site of the academy. Therefore, the principle of the academic world is the bringing in of new information from outside the site, S-I-T-E, the place of the academy, where the academy is located. The academic spirit also fights the local spirit. As Paris did, that the academic spirit fights the local tradition and the local spirit with a different instrument. The tool of the university is the confrontation of opposite opinions. The tool of the academic spirit is the confrontation of theory and fact.